I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's got no fears or phobias at all. Actually, that's a lie. I have lots of phobias.
Okay, hit me with some.
Heights, confined spaces, elevators, hospitals.
Okay, right, you can stop. That's enough. We don't need to, I don't want to get stressed out. I don't like snakes or giant spiders and also heights. They give me the heebie-jeebies. Anyway, let's go to good things. We are carrying on our trip through those sections of the Doctor universe that feature the Time Lords as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm Rebecca Chapman. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audio, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else we can lay our eyes, ears, and hands upon. Today we're heading to the frozen wastes. And today we're heading to the frozen wastes of a Martian moon.
No, we're not talking about Deimos. That's another story for another time. But today we're taking a trip to Phobos. Becca, have you ever done winter sports?
I went to like one of these slope places when I was like a teenager.
Yeah.
And I went, I can't remember what it's called, but you sit on like a rubber ring and go down the snow slopes.
That sounds fun.
It was fun, but it's the only time I've ever done anything remotely winter sporty. Other than that, not at all. What about you?
I have. I used to go skiing in Scotland with my dad, which was always great fun. My dad was brilliant. He skied all over Europe. You know, places like Italy, Switzerland, France, and places like that. And I'm so jealous that I never particularly carried it on. It's something I want to do. I want to, because I love watching the skiing on a Saturday morning in Eurosport and watching all the downhill races and all the amazing backdrop drops and stuff, and think, I want to go there and drink hot chocolate and alcohol in a bar and just watch all the people doing that while I'm wearing a snowsuit and all wrapped up and warm. So I am going to do that one day before I die. It's on my bucket list.
Sounds good.
It should be. So today we are talking about the fifth story featuring Lucy Miller, Phobos, recorded on the 22nd of August 2006, which of course features lots of winter sports, but on a Martian moon. It was broadcast on BBC 7 on the 28th of January 2007 and released on CD in May that year. So before we hear the cover blurb, shall we pop on the trailer?
Yes, hang on, let me find the button.
In the next episode of Doctor Who...
Inner door closing.
Where are we anyway?
Phobos.
Martian Luna Park.
Airlock depressurizing.
Phobos is Greek for fear. They didn't know how right they were when they called it that.
Depressurization complete.
Why did you think Lucy was a monster?
What monsters?
Outer door opening.
Oh, is that Mars up there?
Pretty, isn't it?
Oh, pretty isn't the word.
A senseless, vicious attack and not something a human could have done.
I told you.
Oh, God. More monsters.
I've seen them.
We get them everywhere we go.
Strange animal things.
Didn't they see us coming?
Maybe I'm just good at finding them.
They come from the wormhole.
How far down does it go?
No one knows.
Yeah, nobody's ever hit the bottom.
They're getting closer every day.
Good to go.
Up, up, and away!
Phobos.
Good pressing.
Thank you. So, the TARDIS lands on Phobos, moon of Mars, where extreme sports nuts of the future indulge their passion for gravity boarding and wormhole jumping. But there's something lurking deep in the shadows, something infinitely old and infinitely dangerous. It's not for nothing that Phobos is the ancient word for fear.
Do you know, that's amazing, because I hadn't, until I heard this story, I had absolutely no idea that that's where the connection came from for this moon. I didn't realise it was named. And that's what, you know, the Phobos, phobia, all came from the one thing. I had no idea whatsoever, even though I'd known the names of the Martian moon since I was a wee boy. Did you know that, or am I just being fake?
No, I did know that, but that's only because I love mythology.
I know you do love your mythology. Gosh, I wonder if that story, that series we used to watch is still on, about the gods and stuff.
It's not. They only did the first season.
Oh, well, that's disappointing.
I know.
Oh.
I know.
That may be disappointing and gone, but what did you think of Phobos? I think it's one of those gems.
Yes, I had to make notes because I had a couple of things that I wanted to point out here.
Okay.
So, Phobos is a Greek word.
Mm-hmm.
Mars was the god of war in Roman mythology.
Yep.
And my brain hurt so hard the whole time.
The whole crossing of mythologies.
I was just sat here listening to it. Like, I know that, like, Phobos is actually the moon of Mars. However, no.
No.
Just no. Also, the Doctor torturing a monster, I didn't like that. I loved the episode as a whole. But that felt like the parts of the Doctor that are always hinted at but never shown, and it made me uncomfortable.
Interesting.
Made me deeply uncomfortable.
Because that's sort of like an element of the War Doctor, or the way the 10th Doctor's darker side as well, when he's that no second chances, he's that kind of man. And I quite like that.
Yes.
Obviously, we didn't know the War Doctor was a thing at the time this was created, neither did Stephen Moffat. But there was that sort of foreshadowing element, which I think works quite nicely in retrospect. But again, it's not what you expect. As you say, it's very, very different for the Doctor to do that. But I suppose in some ways it shows what kind of menace he's facing when he's got to do that.
I agree. And, you know, the monster is a terrible monster that can only be killed by fear. So I understand. It doesn't mean I like it.
Great guest cast, this one, isn't it? They're just so well acted, all of them, every single one.
Agreed.
Particularly when you've got, you know, somebody as fantastic as the wonderful Nerys Hughes in there, and Timothy West is just wonderful as Kai. And yeah, it's the fact that he's the one behind the scares, it does have that sort of Scooby-Doo element to it, but that's okay.
It does, and I do really like the redemption of Kai, which I think is probably half the reason I actually really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Because the whole crossing of the mythologies and then the Doctor torturing a monster, maybe I didn't like it. But yeah, no. That's just me being cynical.
Yeah, no, not at all. Useless trivial fact, this story actually was going to be written by my pal up in Dundee, Ian McLaughlin. And it didn't develop the way that Big Finish hoped, and ended up Eddie took over, but the original version was actually going to feature the Yeti in a theme park. So there you go.
Oh, lovely. Also, I would like to touch on how amazing the description of the different characters were.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the whole Polly Pocket Hagrid thing.
Yeah, that was brilliant. I think that was just so clever, because straight away you can picture wee sort of blonde girl and a big hairy person. And
yes, it was perfect.
It's just such a clever, just sort of deft shorthand, and straight away it paints a picture for you, so you know what it's all done for you in the mind's eye. So well done to that man who wrote it. Oh, hang on, that was Eddie Robson. He's an old pal of our podcast. I suppose it doesn't feel right not having him on to chat about his McGann work every now and again, so why don't we have him back to tell us all about Phobos? It'd be kind of stupid if we asked him to tell us about, Grand Theft Cosmos when we've been talking about Phobos. So let's talk about Phobos.
I'm Eddie Robson, and I'm the writer of Phobos.
Eddie, welcome back. It's been a wee while since we had you on. You seem to be like a regular for quite a while.
Well, I did have a period where I was quite a regular doing Eighth Doctor stuff, so I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's always good to come back to you. So let's chat Phobos, because of course you picked this up after you had finished Human Resources, and Ian McLaughlin's original script was, Nick decided not to go with it.
Yeah. So it was, as you say, I'd sort of thought my work was done on the on that season of Eighth Doctor stuff, and then they came to me and they said that this sort of needed a rethink. And it was not clear at the time whether, I was sort of given carte blanche. They said, here's the script. And, it was a case of, I should stress as well that, like, we were sort of in new territory with this. We were kind of trying to stake out a new tone for them. I mean, it wasn't sort of as cynical as, let's make it more like Doctor Who is on TV. I think it was more a case of moving to radio, it was sort of breaking away a bit from that thing of kind of trying to summon up the sense of Doctor Who as it had been on TV, in the various Doctor's eras. And we'd kind of gone away from that a bit with the Eighth Doctor anyway. But I think this was, because we were doing it in 50-minute episodes, it was kind of a decisive break from that. And there was definitely going to be a bit of a new style. And it wasn't quite gelling with the others, I think. It didn't quite, something about it didn't quite fit. So yeah, Alan Barnes said to me, would you have time to do a rewrite on it and try and bring it more in line with the others? And he kind of gave me carte blanche to say, like, you know, if anything that you want to change, you can change. And I must admit, I didn't actually intend initially to change it as much as I did. There was talk quite early on, actually, of, I think it had changed after this. Their initial pitch, which had been accepted, was to do with, it was going to be like a bit more of a Nightmare Fair type thing. It was going to be like a fairground. And the I can't remember at what point, maybe it was while they were working on it, they'd moved it into this thing about extreme sports instead. I think was just a case of everyone sort of feeling like, oh, actually, is there something different we could do with this? Because it kind of feels like fairgrounds, you know, it's maybe been done before, I'd say, in the Nightmare Fair. So yeah, we went with the extreme sports thing instead. My memory actually is that was already in the script when I got it. I'd say I didn't mean to change it as much as I did, but oddly, I think it can often be, when we were working to quite a tight time scale. I remember I had about 10 days to do the rewrite on this. And I was working part-time, had a part-time job at the time as well, so I wasn't free all the time. And yeah, it sort of, rather than kind of carefully moving things around, often it was just easier to just go, I'm just going to rewrite that scene from scratch, even if it doesn't have to be that different. If there's a couple of things that seem like they're quite small, but in fact they kind of completely change the direction of the scene, quite often it's easier to just then, you can actually just get a version of that scene down in a few minutes, like a couple of pages, it can just come out. Whereas you might then spend an hour trying to carefully tweak it to move things around and to move a character from one position to another. Yeah, so that was kind of how it went.
Interesting. It's always interesting how work changes and develops over time. So it's something I did wonder, just when you were talking about extreme sports, have you ever done anything like that, or even snowboarding, or had a skiing holiday?
No, not remotely. No, I've never even had a skiing holiday. But I remember when I was at school, there used to be some of the other wealthier kids used to go off on skiing trips at February half term. And it was just a world that was sort of completely mysterious to me. So no, the closest I've really ever got to extreme sports is that I used to play a lot of Tony Hawk's Pro Skater. That's probably the closest I've ever got to doing it. But it was kind of, it was sort of an interesting mentality to play with. I think that's what Alan was quite keen to go with it, was like, look at that whole kind of mentality. And just, yeah, have characters who are being, we'd put at the heart of it, we'd have a character who was sort of being dragged along with it a bit by someone who was keener on it than they were.
Excellent. Now, I found the fact there's the very interesting story with Eamon Farrell going on, and there's that sort of resistance to the relationship, which I thought was really interesting, and it's sort of something I think that sort of lent a really human element to it, as it were, even though obviously Farrell's not a human.
Yes, yeah.
But where did that one come from? Was that something to sort of to drop in, sort of something we could relate to and sort of humanise an alien world? Or moon?
I guess, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't really know where that came from. No, I think so, yeah. I honestly can't remember this. Hang on. No, I do not remember. I'm trying to work out whether that was originally in it or not. No, I can't remember, I'm afraid.
But how did you find writing for Lucy? Because obviously you'd had a good idea of getting to grips with the character, having done human resources.
Yeah, that was definitely really helpful. Yeah, it was quite good being able to go into it having done that and gone through the editing process with that. And that was definitely an advantage of being able to go back and do it. And it was just nice to be able to get some more time writing the character. And yeah, I'm trying to remember what she actually does in that one. What does she actually do?
she's with Amy and Farrell, and
yeah,
sort of being the human element
between
Kai as well.
That was definitely one of the good things to be able to do, was that knowing what the relationship between her and the headhunter actually was going to be able to kind of go back and do something with that, because with her not knowing yet what was going on. Yeah, that was quite fun to be able to do.
Yeah, and I think that you're building this alien world, particularly with the tunnel, the Tunnel of Fear, perhaps, to borrow an Avengers episode title. Wonderful, because I had never drawn any association between Phobos and phobias. I thought, oh my goodness, why did I never realize that? It's brilliant.
Yeah, now, as I recall, I think I was given that. I think my memory might be at fault here, but I think it was not originally set on Phobos, and I think that was Alan who realized that was the case, and we moved it to Phobos for that reason. It was quite a simple little thing. It only really sort of impacts it on it in that way. But it was sort of, it's as though we could sort of seed those things and say, oh, maybe there's some connection there. The one thing that that I wish I had known, but at some point, only pointed this out after the episode went out, was that I had looked into what Phobos is like in terms of the landscape, and I was like excited that it's sort of all pitted. It's got like lots of big valleys and it's kind of, and things like that. So I thought, oh, that's ideal, like, you know, this of making it this sort of space where people would, you know, this thing of having lots of slopes and a tumultuous landscape. And yeah, someone pointed out after it came out just how small it is, and that was one thing. I sort of looked at pictures of the planet, of the moon, and sort of got, oh yeah, good, I've got a handle on what it's like. And someone said, yeah, it's something ridiculous, like it's actually only like a few miles around, and pointed out that some of it wasn't wrong exactly, but you could sort of tell from some of the descriptions that I'd had, some of the distances that characters were away from each other, that I had not factored that in, and that you could tell, yeah, it didn't quite feel like actually the planet was, the moon was as small as it actually is. So, if I'd known that going in, I would have incorporated it, because actually in some ways it's good, because, you know, the number of alien worlds in sci-fi which kind of feel a bit too small really to be worlds, and it turns out Phobos really is that small. It really is like, you know, this sort of like moon that you can pretty much walk around. So I wish I'd actually been able to take advantage of that.
Eddie, blame it in the Time War. It distorted its geometry.
Yes, yeah. The explanation that I always go for as well in the Doctor Who universe, Phobos is bigger.
It was a Time War. It's inflated its size. Definitely that. How did you find writing for the Doctor and Lucy's relationship? Obviously, you'd had that previous experience to then bring it into this and to make it a bit more bouncy and go with that fun phase before it gets serious later on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that was part of the brief, as I remember, was, well, we've kind of had a bit of them getting to know each other in the earlier episodes, and then you had, if we were, No More Lies was after that, and that's a bit heavier. And then you have the big finale in Human Resources. So the brief was, well, this is just, they can just be having fun at this point. They know each other reasonably well, and not exactly sort of the peak of their relationship, but it's that point when everything's going great, and, you know, they can just sort of enjoy each other's company. And I did try to kind of have that seep through. But it suited the story. I mean, even though it's about fear, it was quite sort of, it was always meant to be quite a sort of high-octane, fast-paced kind of thing, and not to give you a contrast, because it was sitting there in between. I think this was an issue with the original version, was that because it was sort of sitting in between Immortal Beloved and No More Lies, which was sort of a bit more contemplative stories and philosophical, that we felt quite, I was told to be that, you know, you feel quite free to just sort of make this one quite a bit lighter maybe than the other ones, and a bit more action-based.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. It's definitely got more sort of fun and sort of that sense of movement to it all. And it's one you can visualize. I mean, I used to go skiing with my dad when I was younger, and I'm very much picturing some of the Scottish hills and skiing in this. So it's it definitely worked for me that way. Now, give us a wee bit of insight into the actual sort of what the fears that the Doctor encounters going into the wormhole, because I think that's quite dark territory when you've got this sort of all the fun going around and then suddenly
crash. That was sort of part of it. You know, I'm trying to remember it's interesting because this is something that's been developed since in the program were on TV in Listen, and it's sort of come up in other places, the idea of like, what is the Doctor afraid of, but hadn't been particularly, I'm trying to remember now what I actually was thinking in terms of like what it would be facing. I think I maybe at this stage, hang on, so this would have been summer of 2006. I think I probably was thinking in terms of, I might have been thinking in terms of the Time War, a bit of foreshadowing. Like, we weren't at that time allowed to do any foreshadowing of any kind. But I think I wrote with it in mind without saying anything about that, if I remember rightly. I think I was sort of thinking, like, his big fear would be something really cataclysmic like that. But yeah, and then, you know, the idea that, but also, yeah, just the idea that I think actually bigger than that, I think I was just thinking in terms of, you know, he just faces a lot of worst case scenarios all the time. And, you know, no one at this stage has a better sense of, probably no one in the universe has a keener sense of like what could go wrong than the Doctor, because the Doctor's solved so many things, you know, by improvisation and by, you know, the skin of his teeth, that I did kind of think, you know, yeah, he would have a very deep-seated sense of like of how fragile things are. So yeah, I think that was kind of what I had in mind for that. Yeah,
I also really enjoyed the relationship between Kai and Eris. That must have been really good for you to develop, you know, the fact that they're older. Did you imagine them as being older when you wrote it?
Yeah, I did. It was sort of the idea originally was a bit of a sort of, I was thinking in terms of like sort of aging sort of hippie guru type figures, I think. And it was always the idea that it was going to be the sort of, he was going to be that sort of elder statesman figure from a previous generation. And it played very well into what we ended up doing, because they because Barnaby Edwards did the casting for it, and he was just going for all sorts of amazing people. And yeah, it was just amazing to be told sort of, oh yes, yeah, we've got Timothy West and Neris Hughes in it. I was like, it was sort of, which is always a bit of a slightly kind of daunting thing to be told when it's like a script that you've had to do really quickly. Then you kind of like, sort of think, oh right, I know you've given it to them, and I hope it works. Yeah, you know, they're getting really good scripts.
I was always amused by the fact you had Eris played by Neris. So Neris is Eris.
I don't know whether that figured into Barney thinking, whether he just kind of thought, oh, Eris, let's offer it to Neris. Yeah. But yeah,
it works. Another thing that I thought, and please take this as a compliment, because what I'm referring to is one of my favourite shows. There was an element of the Scooby-Doo Where Are You in there.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
Kai scaring off the people with the Phobian creature. I thought that was, it really amused me, and just thought, that as a total compliment, because it's one of my favourite tunes.
Well, as I say, it did start life as something that was going to be about a weird fairground. So I think the sort of DNA of Scooby-Doo was sort of in it from the beginning, really. Yeah, I wonder if Scooby-Doo has ever done a story about extreme sports. I bet they have. They've done so many episodes of Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
There must be one in there. Yep. Yeah, all the different theories.
All these new ones they do, like Scooby-Doo meets WWF, Scooby-Doo, or WWE, sorry. Can tell my age there, giving away that I've still referred to it as the F, not the E. And Scooby-Doo meets Batman, that sort of thing. So yes, there's a lot of crossovers in the Warnerverse, if such a thing exists.
Yeah, well, it does. They've been doing it. I won't get into that because it's not really relevant to the podcast. But yeah, they've done. They've been mashing up a lot of things recently. There's a computer game called Multiverses where they mash them all up. Yeah, who knows? Maybe one of the many Disney-verse mashup things will include Doctor Who at some point.
Well, I suppose you do get to back in the early days of DWM. Stan Lee presents Doctor Who and the Star Beast and things like that. Doctor Who and the Iron
Legends. Yeah, well, actually, there's one thing that was a big deal for me, because before I read Doctor Who magazine, I was a keen reader of Transformers comic.
Oh, yes.
And it was really around the time that I was kind of jumping off that, because they started going out to reprints of stuff that I already had. So I was looking in 1989 to take up another title. And when I crossed over to Doctor Who magazine, it was around the time when they were doing crossovers with the other Marvel UK titles. And so to me, it was all sort of part of the same thing, really. I thought of Doctor Who as being part of the Marvel universe in its own little UK corner.
Death's Head, yes.
Mm.
See what I did there?
Yeah, Death's Head.
Yes, we definitely have the same cultural reference points here, Eddie, which is fab. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier there the casting, and just what a fantastic cast you've got. I mean, how many TV shows would kill to have the likes of Paul McGann, Sheridan Smith, Neris Hughes, and Timothy West in them? It's just sort of four fantastic leading actors.
Yeah, it was a shame. I wasn't able, because I live up in Lancaster, I wasn't able to go down for the whole thing. I was only able to go down for a few days, so I decided to do it around human resources instead, because I could do that as a block of two. So, but I did. It's a shame I wasn't actually down for the Phobos recording. That would have been lovely.
So the first thing you'd have heard it would have been on transmission on BBC 7.
Yes, yeah. Good. I always have a slight resistance to listening to my own stuff, because I don't know, it's sort of like it. To me, it's a bit like playing your own voice back at you when you have to listen to your own voice, as I'm sure you have to do quite often to, you know, put these podcasts together and stuff. I have a similar sort of aversion to it. But the nice thing about them being broadcast is that I always want to hear them on broadcast. It always sounds a bit different on broadcast when you get something done. Just the knowledge that other people are listening to it at the same time makes you hear it a bit differently. So it sort of forces me to go, okay, well, I've got to listen to it now, because there might not be another opportunity. And yeah, no, it was, so actually it ended up being my first ever broadcast work, oddly. And it sort of, which would have been human resources, but then this sort of came in and I ended up doing that. So although it was an odd assignment, I do sort of think of it quite fondly for that reason, just because it was the first thing I'd ever had broadcast, you know, and it was on on the actual BBC. So yeah, that was very exciting.
Yeah, and when the CD came out as well, a nice chilly looking cover with those whites and frozen blues.
It was I'll tell you what was good about that was that I did a signing for that one at the Who shop, and it had lots of good space to sign into, so that was good. It was around an event that had been arranged for the purposes of signing that, so I was there for that, but also the Timelash DVD. So Paul Darrow and somebody else, the Timelash cast, I can't remember who it was, one of the other guest casts from Timelash. Yeah, so I was sat there signing with Paul Darrow, which was good. He's no longer with us, of course, but he was a tremendously entertaining man. There was one bit where someone came up to say, this is for my son, I don't really know anything about it, I don't know who you are, and Darrow just said, George Clooney, pleased to meet you. And then he turned to me and said, and this is Daniel Radcliffe. So that was, and there was another, there was someone who came with a small child called Shane. And anyone who had met Darrow, I think, would know of his great love of the film Shane and his tendency to act out scenes from it at the slightest provocation. So we got treated to that. That was great.
That's amazing. That's lovely to have that extra little bit of a memory and, of, again, another star of our childhood.
Yeah.
So how do you look back on the whole Phobos experience?
Yeah, well, it was sort of... it's a bit... I think the thing that's a bit tricky with a job like that, where you've had to do it really quickly and it's sort of been, you know, to try and change direction with something that was somebody else's project, is that at the time, I mean, everyone who's working on it, if you do a decent job of it, everyone who's working on it with you is really pleased, because, you know, you've sort of solved a problem for them. But I think what was kind of interesting was that, like, because Ian said, he was very gracious about it, really nice, and he just said, you know, there'd been talk of like how it was going to be credited, and it's like it was possible that it would have still been credited to him, or it might have been credited as a co-write. But in the end, Ian said, there's very little of my original story in it, and I would just feel like a thief if I took a credit on it, so I'm absolutely fine. And they just, yeah, they thought it all out contractually, and then sort of went out as mine. And so for a number of years, I thought, you know, I thought it would not be politics to talk about. It'd just be unfair to talk about the whole process that had gone behind it. But you sort of think, oh, well, it's going out and people don't know what's happened behind the scenes. And like, there were things like, I mean, one thing that came up was that someone said, well, isn't this whole thing of like this hole that you dive into and it's got some creature in it that's sort of demonic? isn't this basically the impossible planet? And I thought, bloody hell, actually, it kind of is. It is not dissimilar. And I didn't think of make the connection at all at the time. But those were, I do know that I was writing it during the group stage of the 2006 World Cup, which means the Impossible Planet had just been on TV. I thought it might have seeped in. And it's kind of hard to say, well, you know, I had to do it really quick. And sometimes when you're writing quickly, you know, things seep in subconsciously that if you had a bit more time, you might have thought through a bit more. But I didn't want to kind of, I don't know, I didn't want to feel like it was a sort of special pleading, because, you know, it's sort of annoying when people do that, when people say, oh yeah, but you know, you have to make allowances for that, you know, because why should the listeners care? Because, you know, they've paid their money regardless. So yeah, for a while I was sort of a bit, well, it was not, you know, it's not how I'd necessarily have chosen to kind of make my debut on radio and that sort of thing. But I think it went okay in the end. I feel like it did get overshadowed a bit by Human Resources. That was the one that people talked about later, and I'm sort of, you know, and that doesn't bother me. I'm kind of fine with that. That was the one that really said things that were important to me and that I'd kind of, you know, poured myself into. So I think overall it worked out fine, and I'm happy to have done it. It was a good exercise to have done, to have had to try and rework something in that way. And I think, yeah, considering the time constraints and everything, I think it went pretty well.
I agree. It definitely did. It's very memorable and entertaining for all the right reasons. So thank you for that. So Eddie, tell us what you've been up to lately and where people can find out what you've been working on and where they can buy it and what they can buy. Ooh.
Well, what have I been doing lately? In the recent months, I've launched a horror game on a platform called Richcast, which is called Liminal Hotel. And I got approached to do that last year. And that was quite fun because they've got a whole system for making interactive stories where you can kind of, they've done all the programming parts. And so you just log in and there's a board. And it's a bit like carding out scenes when you're trying to plot something, except you sort of like lay down these cards that go like image, dialogue, choice, and that sort of thing, and it sort of sparks off. So you can do, because they've done all the programming, someone like me who has no knowledge of coding whatsoever can just make it work. So that was a lot of fun to do. It was very satisfying when I managed to get the hang of the logic system and make it so that if you've already done this path once, then the dialogue is different and all that sort of thing. That was enjoyable to do. I've also, in recent months, I've done an e-book of my columns from the Doctor Who figurine collection, which is called Do Time Lords Get Drunk? A lot of those, I don't know, because the thing is, because of the nature of the magazine, you know, it came with the figurines, so if you weren't buying the figurines, then you wouldn't have seen this stuff. And even with some of them, like some of the, because of the way that it went under, we were working quite far in advance on these. And several of the columns were in magazines that were never printed, and some were in columns that were printed, but they never went out. And they, so, you know, you can get them on eBay and things, but I think they might be a bit pricey. And I wrote a little bit of new material as well, because I realised I hadn't got anything for Paul McGann. So I did something on the TV movie, and then I didn't have anything on Hartnell either. And I was a bit thin on David Tennant stuff, so I did three new columns and finished off one on the Two Doctors. And basically, it's just looking at questions that arise, points of continuity, plot holes, things that don't seem to quite make sense, or are kind of threads left hanging in Doctor Who. And it's sort of, as you would suggest, it's sort of quite irreverent. And, you know, I hope it's quite funny, and I hope some people find something that they hadn't maybe thought of themselves. But it's always an enjoyable thing to do.
So where can people find that?
It's on at the moment. It's on Amazon and it's on Kobo, I believe. I tried to put it on Apple Books, but it didn't work. It went into, every time I tried to log in and actually upload the book, it just sent me into a loop of making me log in
again. No.
So fix the website then.
What's the name people should be looking for? Eddie Robson, and
it is Do Time Lords Get Drunk.
Fantastic.
Which came up in. Someone, possibly Johnny Morris, immediately said, well, that question is answered in The Twin Dilemma. And I'm like, yes, it is. But that's that's where it came up. I did a bit on The Twin Dilemma.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So those are the main things I've been doing. My last novel, of course, came out in paperback in the summer, which is Drunk on All Your Strange New Words. But apart from that, I'm sort of in the position of first time in quite a long time, I don't have a lot of things lined up waiting to come out. Most, I think nearly everything, apart from a few of my computer games books that I've been writing, it's an unusual feeling to not have anything that's sort of in the works, but you know, hopefully soon.
Fantastic. Eddie, thank you once again for your time.
A huge thanks to Eddie. And yes, as you said earlier, there is that big Scooby-Doo element to it.
Yeah, he would have got away with it if it wasn't for that meddling Time Lord. So, we've spoken to the writer. Perhaps we should speak to one of the guest cast on this one. And it's time for a wee word with Tim Sutton, who played Hagrid. Sorry, Varl the Githian.
My name's Tim Sutton, and I played the part of Farl in Eddie Robson's Phobos for Big Finish.
Welcome to Pieces of Eighth, Tim. It's always a delight to welcome somebody new to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks, Kenny. Love to see you.
I suppose the first question I should hit you with is, do you remember the first time you saw the Paul McGann TV movie?
Right. Yes, but I haven't seen it for... I think I saw it when it came out, and I think that's it. I think that's the first and last time I saw it. I remember there was a kiss, which was very scandalous. Time Lord snogs and all that. But I'd like to revisit it at some point. I mean, the fact that all the Doctor Who archive is on TV is now available is just, I was scrolling through the other day and it's sort of overwhelming, really. It's, you know, I thought, well, I'd love to see that and I'd love to see that, but that's going to sort of take me 3 months. So it's hard to know where to start. I mean, I suppose the most exciting things that ever came on TV for me were one, the Regenerations, but I think even more so were the Three Doctors and the Five Doctors when they came through. That was a really exciting time, you know, the idea of them all getting together. So yeah, so I will revisit the TV movie at some point, but it may not be for a few years.
Absolutely. I think also the fact that you've just named the Three and Five Doctors, you have just outed yourself as being a proper fan as well.
Well, I was certainly devoted to it for a long while, you know, in my, I suppose when I was 9, 10, 11, 12, that sort of time, around the end of Tom Baker, Peter Davison Regeneration, that was my peak period. So I mean, I think that was absolutely a golden age, and it was wonderful to work with Peter on Time in Office a few years ago, which was my most recent Big Finish adventure.
What do you recall about being cast as Farrell and Phobos?
Well, I just remember being very flattered, really, very kind of grateful to Barnaby for giving me the call, because I think it was the first time I'd been involved in a Big Finish audio drama where I wasn't the composer. You know, so whenever I was acting, like in The Pirates, you know, I had those little parts. But in terms of my acting, I was sort of slight imposter syndrome, that I was sort of, you know, I was just a useful voice that happened to be around to slot the music in or to do some musical direction. With Phobos, you know, that was my only involvement. So it was a really nice opportunity for me to play a part, you know, unadulterated, without any strings attached.
How did Barney sell the part to you? Because it's not your everyday acting part, the fact that you're playing an alien who's quite a big, strong chap, and he's in relationship with a human, and some people are frowning upon it. And I think it's, he's like a great character.
Yes, I mean, you know, to be honest, I would have done anything that Barnaby asked, really. So I wasn't too analytical about the part itself. I mean, it seemed like a really interesting role with this sort of this conflict and this family in exile, as it were, or in this renegade family, and you know, and it spoke about prejudice as well, and relationship difficulties as. So it felt like there was a lot to get one's teeth into. So I enjoyed doing it as well. Of course, they, you know, put this extraordinary effect on the voice, I mean, listen, I had a listen back the other night to it, because I haven't listened to it for what year was it, Phobos?
2007.
Blimey, so 16 years ago. So I just had my second child. It was just about to take her A levels. Listening back, I wonder if I would find more to do in the part this time around. He's quite a kind of Mardy bum, really, isn't he? He's quite sort of he's quite put out a lot of the time. You know, I think if I were to go back, I might kind of find a little bit more of a spark. But you know, one can't go back. And I think interesting, because I did the effects didn't get put on until after, and I wonder if I had been hearing that effect in real time, whether that would have changed the performance as well. But I think I've gone through a lot of development, I suppose, as an actor since I did that. You know, I've had a sort of little explosion of sort of voiceover work, some TV ads and that sort of thing. And I was on the road for a few months at the end of last year and the beginning of this year with the production of The Lavender Hill Mob with Miles Jupp and Justin Edwards, doing a tour of regional theatres, which I really enjoyed. And I think I became a much better, much more rounded actor as a result, you know. So I'm very grateful to Barnaby for giving me the opportunity. And sometimes you just think, well, I'd love to have gone back and just have another go at it with knowing what I know now. But I mean, the joy of it was hearing the extraordinary performances of all the other cast, you know. I had actually forgotten it was Timothy West. I thought, that voice is so familiar. And then, of course, in the interviews, you go, oh, of course it was Timothy West. And such a, you know, Neris Hughes, just such extraordinarily nuanced and talented actors. So for me, the greatest joy was listening back and going, my goodness, I was in some royal company there.
I think it is a tremendous cast, and I think that everybody just has a great part. And I think, to be fair, Farrell does have a good reason to be a Mardy bum. Best description I've ever heard, given the rather nasty people who are around him at times. But
he does. It's not a great setup.
Have you ever done winter sports yourself? Is this something you've ever done, skiing?
I have done skiing. Yeah, I skied at school. I had a couple of ski trips where I learnt in sort of sixth form, as it was called then, when I lived in Lancashire. So we went off to Val d'Isère and to what's called Zellamsee, I think, in Austria. And then my brother-in-law lives in Zurich with his family. So we've had a couple of opportunities to go out there and go on the slopes. But I have to say, I'm really desperate to go again. And I'm very conscious that, what with the planet warming up as it is, there may be no skiing in Europe in 10 years' time. It actually is very scary, you know, that some of the sort of some of the snow that used to hang around in summer is not there anymore. We were thinking about maybe going out in the new year. I mean, talking about age, I've sort of turned 50 this year, and the other thing that's happened in the last 5 years is just an intermittent bad back. Fortunately, nothing, touch wood, hasn't assailed me for the last 18 months or so. But I just don't know. I know, cross fingers and cross spines. You know, I just don't know whether I would cope, whether the actual action of skiing, you know, taking a tumble would just sort of wreck my back again. So sort of these things that I never had to consider the last time I was up there. I mean, it's the most amazing feeling. Never snowboarded, but no, I just love the experience of that. I love the speed. I love the being up in the mountains. That's, I suppose, my most extreme sport, although I've had the odd twisted ankle playing tennis. And you know, and I love swimming. I love sort of lake swimming and so on, and river swimming. When we're in holiday, we get down to France. That's only extreme sports if I ever get into trouble, which I try not to do. But I've never sort of jumped out of aeroplanes or anything like that.
No, that's not for me either. But I used to do skiing in my younger days up in the Highlands of Scotland, so it's something that I'd love to be able to do again. I always quite fancy going over to Switzerland at this time of year and see, yes, you know, and then going to ski lodge at the end and getting a hot chocolate or something like that.
Oh yes, the old Glühwein.
Absolutely, that sounds that's more me. Or just eating Toblerone all day and, yeah, just watch, exactly, people doing it. So
all the Swiss people do is, you know, mulled wine and Toblerone with a knife and fork.
Oh, counting their money and for their Swiss bank account.
Well, yeah.
So was it quite a happy recording session?
Yes. I mean, I remember as much as I do remember, you know, so trying to raid the memory banks. I was talking about pirates on Sirens of Audio, and that's 20 years ago. I was like, well, it is a long time to remember these things, but I think it was very happy, and of course Barnaby is such a wonderful director, and he's so efficient and warm and welcoming and specific with the notes that he gives, that it's always a pleasure, you know, to work with him. I haven't seen him for, you know, for years and years and years, but I mean, he always runs a very jolly ship, if you'll forgive another nautical pun. and I liked the, you know, listening back, I'd sort of forgotten what happened, but I love these, you know, any play where you have a sort of abstract concept at the heart of it, of fear at the heart of it, you know, as you, it makes you tingle a little bit, doesn't it? Sort of, you know, these primal fears. Obviously, Doctor Who kind of gets into that quite a lot, the idea of these things that scare us all, and people being driven mad by fear, and ultimately, of course, fighting the monster with its own weapon, which was really, really neat. And I can't remember whether I was actually there on the same day as Timothy West. I think I probably wasn't, but I remember Sheridan Smith very well. He was absolutely lovely. He's a wonderful human being. And she gave me a lift home, or a lift to the station. And I remember her car was just the full of rubbish. it was the most untidy car I've ever been in, but she was an absolute dream. A lovely person.
Yeah, I think she always comes across well, and once described me as her favourite ever journalist, so I'll take that.
There you go.
Which is good. And of course, you did get to have a good few scenes with Katarina Olsen, who's fantastic as Amy.
Yes. Yeah, she was, you know, again, just another fantastic actor. You know, it's extraordinary how Big Finish keeps getting them, you know, all these top flight actors who have a day off or two just to kind of pop into the studio. And yeah, as I say, my biggest memory is just being able to be around that sort of quality and learning from them, you know, seeing the inflections, you know, and it's all in the voice, you know, it's everything that happens is just in that tiny piece of muscle in our larynx. That's all you got to conjure the imagination. I've really enjoyed doing voiceover work. I got a Carphone Warehouse advert just sort of weirdly about 6 or 7 years ago, a jingle that Adam Buxton had written for them that I ended up voicing and singing advert. and that sort of work feeds my actor need, my actor center, really, these days. And it, you know, taking whatever scripts, good or bad, and enlivening it, informing it in as much as you can in the sort of slightly strange situation. But I absolutely love just you and the mic, and that's all you have is the best feeling sometimes, I think. And being able to take direction and modulate accordingly, you know, and sometimes it goes really well and sometimes it sort of doesn't quite feel right. But I guess that's true of life in general, isn't it? You know, so you have things that you meet and it's a great partnership, and then sometimes you can't quite find your way into it. But it's a fascinating world. And of course, because most of what I do is it involves composing music, you know, the actual technical nature of audio is very much in my mind all the time, you know, how you create tension and release within a piece of music or a soundscape or whatever. So yeah, I always relish those opportunities.
Mentioned their musical composition. Of course, you did the glam rock theme earlier in the season, which is just a work of genius, and it makes me laugh. How did that come about?
Oh, well, that was something else again. I mean, that was the great Nick Pegg giving me a musical education. You know, I knew a bit of David Bowie. Of course, you saw him on Top of the Pops growing up in the 70s and early 80s, but I hadn't really... You know, I wasn't really into pop music when I was growing up, and it was the getting a basically a mixtape from Nick Pegg in order to prep for the music of glam rock, just sort of opened my eyes to the extraordinary Bowie legacy. You know, I had no idea quite what a journey that was, and that's turned me into a kind of Bowie fan for the rest of time, really. And there's always so much more to discover. But there was T-Rex, of course, as well, and I think to be honest, T-Rex is much more the informed that that very specific take on the Doctor Who theme tune. So it was good just sort of yowling into a mic in my studio and putting that together. And also, I think I sort of bought an electric guitar and I was trying to play the guitar. I think that would be kind of the attempts at electric guitar on that score are very, very amateurish. I think probably, I haven't listened to that one back for a while, but I think it was very much a sort of amateur soundscape and maybe that's part of the charm of it as well. But yeah, I mean, I've had three chances to redo or do my own version of the Doctor Who theme tune, and that was certainly one of the most enjoyable.
It's a classic. I do like it, and I actually have it as a ringtone on my phone. So I've got various versions, and that's one of them. So there we go. Word. So thank you very much for when people call me, others get entertained by that. So there we go.
Good Lord, I had no idea. Those are these things that you just kind of pass through your lives. You had no idea how they'll stick around.
Yeah, I'm afraid that says quite a lot about me as well. So there we go. But Tim, thank you so much.
Very
it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat.
A pleasure, Kenny. Great to see you.
Thanks again to Tim. How amazing was his version of the Doctor Who theme at the end of Horror of Glam Rock, which we couldn't get hold of him to speak to about at the time when we did our Horror of Glam Rock episode. Brilliant, isn't it?
I loved that. That was so good.
Yeah. Wah, wah, wah. I was just doing my ear 70s guitar there just to be a bit glam rock, and I've put on a mirrored hat as well with lots of badges on my denim jacket.
Oh yeah, he spun it around his head. Spun it round his head. He nearly hit himself in the chin. It was horrendous.
Yeah, but no, brilliant work by Tim. Great performance as well. And this one, just managing to capture that sort of being slightly distant and doing his best to keep his cool when there's some pretty scumbaggy people around him. So, yeah, poor Farrell. Yes. I did feel sympathy for him. So, do you wonder what the baby would look like?
Oh, but blonde and hairy.
Yeah, we'll go for that. Blonde and hairy baby. So yeah, that'll work.
Like most babies. That was something that confused me, how hairy my little boy was when he was born. It was just like, why is there so much hair? You look like a werewolf.
Oh, it's typical man though, isn't it? It's only going to get worse.
Unfortunately. Also, like, babies are born without eyebrows. Like, I knew this. But his eyebrows formed from his head hair as his head hair receded as he lost it.
Oh my God.
And I was just watching this happen, going, is that normal? Surely that's not, what is this?
Is he a Githian?
I think he might be, just in disguise.
Mm.
He's in the, like, 99th percentile for height and for weight. He's estimated to be, like, 6'7" by the time he's 17.
Is he Richard Osman?
I think he bloody might be. He's huge.
Oh, well, good job he's out now and he's not growing inside you when he's 6'7". That would be troublesome.
Can you imagine?
No.
It was bad enough anyway.
No, we're not going there. We're staying away from there. We're not getting you upset and back to the trauma. No, move away. Move away. Moving along.
It's okay. I have been through therapy. I have only got 3 sessions left and I'm doing very well.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. Well, until tomorrow, when we'll be taking a short trip on another festive adventure. I've been Rebecca Chapman.
And I've been Kenny Smith, and we will see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Indeed we will. Bye.